Random House Audiobooks presents The Reader by Bernhard Schlink. Read for you by Campbell Scott.
The Reader. Part 1. Chapter 1. When I was 15, I got hepatitis. It started in the fall and lasted until spring. As the old year darkened and turned colder, I got weaker and weaker. Things didn't start to improve until the new year. January was warm, and my mother moved my bed out onto the balcony. I saw sky, sun, clouds, and heard the voices of children playing in the courtyard. As dusk came one evening in February, there was the sound of a blackbird singing. The first time I ventured outside, it was to go from Blumenstrasse, where we lived on the second floor of a massive turn-of-the-century building, to Bahnhofstrasse. That's where I'd thrown up on the way home from school one day the previous October. I'd been feeling weak for days in a way that was completely new to me. Every step was an effort. When I was faced with stairs either at home or at school, my legs would hardly carry me. I had no appetite. Even if I sat down at the table hungry, I soon felt queasy. I woke up every morning with a dry mouth and the sensation that my insides were in the wrong place and too heavy for my body. I was ashamed of being so weak. I was even more ashamed when I threw up. That was another thing that had never happened to me before. My mouth was suddenly full. I tried to swallow everything down again and clenched my teeth with my hand in front of my mouth, but it all burst out of my mouth anyway, straight through my fingers. I leaned against the wall of the building, looking down at the vomit around my feet, and retched something clear and sticky. When rescue came, it was almost an assault. The woman seized my arm and pulled me through the dark entryway into the courtyard. Up above there were lines strung from window to window, loaded with laundry. Wood was stacked in the courtyard. In an open workshop, a saw screamed, and shavings flew. The woman turned on the tap, washed my hand first, and then cupped both of hers and threw water in my face. I dried myself with a handkerchief. "Get that one." There were two pails standing by the faucet. She grabbed one and filled it. I took the other one, filled it, and followed her through the entryway. She swung her arm, the water sluiced down across the walk, and washed the vomit into the gutter. Then she took my pail and sent a second wave of water across the walk. When she straightened up, she saw I was crying. "Hey, kid," she said, startled. "Hey, kid," and took me in her arms. I wasn't much taller than she was. I could feel her breasts against my chest. I smelled the sourness of my own breath and felt her fresh sweat as she held me and didn't know where to look. I stopped crying. She asked me where I lived, put the pails down in the entryway, and took me home, walking beside me, holding my school bag in one hand and my arm in the other. It's no great distance from Bahnhofstrasse to Blumenstrasse. She walked quickly, and her decisiveness helped me to keep pace with her. She said goodbye in front of our building. That same day my mother called in the doctor, who diagnosed hepatitis. At some point I told my mother about the woman. If it hadn't been for that, I don't think I would have gone to see her. But my mother simply assumed that as soon as I was better, I would use my pocket money to buy some flowers, go introduce myself, and say thank you, which was why at the end of February I found myself heading for Bahnhofstrasse. Chapter 2. The building on Bahnhofstrasse is no longer there. I don't know when or why it was torn down. I was away from my hometown for many years. The new building, which must have been put up in the 70s or 80s, has 5 floors plus finished space under the roof, is devoid of balconies or arched windows, and its smooth facade is an expanse of pale plaster. A plethora of doorbells indicates a plethora of tiny apartments, with tenants moving in and out as casually as you would pick up and return a rented car. There's a computer store on the ground floor where once there was a pharmacy, a supermarket, and a video store. The old building was as tall, but with only 4 floors, a first floor of faceted sandstone blocks, and above it three floors of brickwork with sandstone arches, balconies, and window surrounds. Several steps led up to the first floor and the stairwell. They were wide at the bottom, narrower above, set between walls topped with iron banisters and curving outwards at street level. The front door was flanked by pillars, and from the corners of the architrave one lion looked up Bahnhofstrasse while another looked down. The entryway through which the woman had led me to the tap in the courtyard was a side entrance. I had been aware of this building since I was a little boy. It dominated the whole row. I used to think that if it made itself any heavier and wider, the neighboring buildings would have to move aside and make room for it. Inside I imagined a stairwell with plaster moldings, mirrors, and an oriental runner held down with highly polished brass rods. I assumed that grand people would live in such a grand building. But because the building had darkened with the passing of the years and the smoke of the trains, I imagined that the grand inhabitants would be just as somber and somehow peculiar, deaf or dumb or hunchbacked or lame. In later years I dreamed about the building again and again. The dreams were similar, variations on one dream and one theme. I'm walking through a strange town and I see the house. It's one in a row of buildings in a district I don't know. I go on, confused, because the house is familiar but its surroundings are not. Then I realize that I've seen the house before. I'm not picturing Bahnhofstrasse in my hometown, but another city, or another country. For example, in my dream I'm in Rome, see the house, and realize I've seen it already in Bern. This dream recognition comforts me. Seeing the house again in different surroundings is no more surprising than encountering an old friend by chance in a strange place. I turn around, walk back to the house, and climb the steps. I want to go in. I turn the door handle. If I see the house somewhere in the country, the dream is more long drawn out, or I remember its details better. I'm driving a car. I see the house on the right and keep going, confused at first only by the fact that such an obviously urban building is standing there in the middle of the countryside. Then I realize that this is not the first time I've seen it, and I'm doubly confused. When I remember where I've seen it before, I turn around and drive back. In the dream, the road is always empty, as I can turn around with my tires squealing and race back. I'm afraid I'll be too late, and I drive faster. Then I see it. It is surrounded by fields, rape or wheat or vines in the Palatinate, lavender in Provence. The landscape is flat, or at most, gently rolling. There are no trees. The day is cloudless, the sun is shining, the air shimmers and the road glitters in the heat. The firewalls make the building look unprepossessing and cut off. They could be the firewalls of any building. The house is no darker than it was on Bahnhofstrasse, but the windows are so dusty that you can't see anything inside the rooms, not even the curtains. It looks blind. I stop on the side of the road and walk over to the entrance. There's nobody about, not a sound to be heard, not even a distant engine, a gust of wind, a bird. The world is dead. I go up the steps and turn the knob. But I do not open the door. I wake up, knowing simply that I took hold of the knob and turned it. Then the whole dream comes back to me, and I know that I've dreamed it before. Chapter 3. I didn't know the woman's name. Clutching my bunch of flowers, I hesitated in front of the door and all the bells. I would rather have turned around and left, but then a man came out of the building, asked who I was looking for, and directed me to Frau Schmitz on the third floor. No decorative plaster, no mirrors, no runner. Whatever unpretentious beauty the stairwell might once have had, it could never have been comparable to the grandeur of the façade, and it was long gone in any case. The red paint on the stairs had worn through in the middle. The stamped green linoleum that was glued on the walls to shoulder height was rubbed away to nothing, and bits of string had been stretched across the gaps in the banisters. It smelled of cleaning fluid. Perhaps I only became aware of all this sometime later. It was always just as shabby and just as clean, and there was always the same smell of cleaning fluid, sometimes mixed with the smell of cabbage or beans, or fried food, or boiling laundry. I never learned a thing about the other people who lived in the building apart from these smells, the mats outside the apartment doors, and the nameplates under the doorbells. I cannot even remember meeting another tenant on the stairs. Nor do I remember how I greeted Frau Schmitz. I had probably prepared two or three sentences about my illness and her help and how grateful I was, and recited them to her. She led me into the kitchen. It was the largest room in the apartment and contained a stove and sink, a tub and a boiler, a table, two chairs, a kitchen cabinet, a wardrobe, and a couch with a red velvet spread thrown over it. There was no window. Light came in through the panes of the door leading out onto the balcony. Not much light. The kitchen was only bright when the door was open. Then you heard the scream of the saws from the carpenter's shop in the yard, and smelled the smell of wood. The apartment also had a small, cramped living room, with a dresser, a table, four chairs, a wing chair, and a coal stove. It was almost never heated in winter, nor was it used much in summer either. The window faced Bahnhofstrasse with a view of what had been the railroad station, but was now being excavated, and already in places held the freshly laid foundations of the new courthouse and administration buildings. Finally, the apartment also had a windowless toilet. When the toilet smelled, so did the hall. I don't remember what we talked about in the kitchen. Frau Schmitz was ironing. She had spread a woolen blanket and a linen cloth over the table. Lifting one piece of laundry after another from the basket, she ironed them, folded them, and laid them on one of the two chairs. I sat on the other. She also ironed her underwear, and I didn't want to look, but I couldn't help looking. She was wearing a sleeveless smock, blue with little pale red flowers on it. Her shoulder-length ash-blonde hair was fastened with a clip at the back of her neck. Her bare arms were pale. Her gestures of lifting the iron, using it, setting it down again, and then folding and putting away the laundry, were an exercise in slow concentration, as were her movements as she bent over and then straightened up again. Her face, as it was then, has been overlaid in my memory by the faces she had later. If I see her in my mind's eye as she was then, she doesn't have a face at all, and I have to reconstruct it. High forehead, high cheekbones, pale blue eyes, full lips that formed a perfect curve without any indentation, square chin, a broad-planed, strong, womanly face. I know that I found it beautiful, but I cannot recapture its beauty. Chapter 4. Wait, she said as I got up to go. I have to leave too, and I'll walk with you. I waited in the hall while she changed her clothes in the kitchen. The door was open a crack. She took off the smock and stood there in a bright green slip. Two stockings were hanging over the back of the chair. Picking one up, she gathered it into a roll using one hand, then the other, then balanced on one leg as she rested the heel of her other foot against her knee, leaned forward, slipped the rolled-up stocking over the tip of her foot, put her foot on the chair as she smoothed the stocking up over her calf, knee, and thigh, then bent to one side as she fastened the stocking to the garter belt. Straightening up, she took her foot off the chair and reached for the other stocking. I couldn't take my eyes off her. Her neck and shoulders, her breasts, which the slip veiled rather than concealed, her hips, which stretched the slip tight as she propped her foot on her knee and then set it on the chair, her leg, pale and naked, then shimmering in the silky stocking. She felt me looking at her. As she was reaching for the other stocking, she paused, turned towards the door, and looked straight at me. I can't describe what kind of look it was. Surprised, skeptical, knowing, reproachful. I turned red. For a fraction of a second I stood there, my face burning. Then I couldn't take it anymore. I fled out of the apartment, down the stairs, and into the street. I dawdled along. Bahnhofstrasse, Hauserstrasse, Blumenstrasse. It had been my way to school for years. I knew every building, every garden, and every fence. The ones that were repainted every year and the ones that were so gray and rotten that I could crumble the wood in my hand. The iron railings that I ran along as a child banging a stick against the posts. And the high brick wall behind which I had imagined wonderful and terrible things until I was able to climb it and see row after boring row of neglected beds of flowers, berries, and vegetables. I knew the cobblestones in their layer of tar on the road, and the changing surface of the sidewalk, from flagstones to little lumps of basalt set in wave patterns, tar, and gravel. It was all familiar. When my heart stopped pounding and my face was no longer scarlet, the encounter between the kitchen and the hall seemed a long way away. I was angry with myself. I had run away like a child, instead of keeping control of the situation as I thought I should. I wasn't 9 years old anymore, I was 15. That didn't mean I had any idea what keeping control would have entailed. The other puzzle was the actual encounter that had taken place between the kitchen and the hall. Why had I not been able to take my eyes off her? She had a very strong feminine body, more voluptuous than the girls I liked and watched. I was sure I wouldn't even have noticed her if I'd seen her at the swimming pool. Nor had she been any more naked than the girls and women I'd already seen at the swimming pool. And besides, she was much older than the girls I dreamed about. Over 30? It's hard to guess ages when you're not that old yourself, and won't be any time soon. Years later, it occurred to me that the reason I hadn't been able to take my eyes off her was not just her body, but the way she held herself and moved. I asked my girlfriends to put on stockings, but I didn't want to explain why, or to talk about the riddle of what had happened between the kitchen and the hall. So my request was read as a desire for garters and high heels and erotic extravaganza, and if it was granted, it was done as a come-on. There had been none of that when I had found myself unable to look away. She hadn't been posing or teasing me. I don't remember her ever doing that. I remember that her body and the way she held it and moved sometimes seemed awkward. Not that she was particularly heavy. It was more as if she had withdrawn into her own body and left it to itself and its own quiet rhythms, unbothered by any input from her mind, oblivious to the outside world. It was the same obliviousness that weighed in her glance and her movements when she was pulling on her stockings. But then she was not awkward. She was slow-flowing, graceful, seductive, a seductiveness that had nothing to do with breasts and hips and legs, but was an invitation to forget the world in the recesses of the body. I knew none of this, if indeed I know any of it now and am not just making patterns in the air. But as I thought back then on what had excited me, the excitement came back. To solve the riddle, I made myself remember the whole encounter, and then the distance I had created by turning it into a riddle dissolved, and I saw it all again, and again I couldn't take my eyes off her. Chapter 5. A week later, I was standing at her door again. For a week I had tried not to think about her, but I had nothing else to occupy or distract me. The doctor was not ready to let me go back to school. I was bored stiff with books after months of reading, and although friends still came to see me, I had been sick for so long that their visits could no longer bridge the gap between their daily lives and mine, and became shorter and shorter. I was supposed to go for walks a little further each day, without overexerting myself. I could have used the exertion. Being ill when you are a child or growing up is such an enchanted interlude. The outside world, the world of free time in the yard or the garden or on the street, is only a distant murmur in the sick room. Inside, a whole world of characters and stories proliferates out of the books you read. The fever that weakens your perception as it sharpens your imagination turns the sick room into someplace new, both familiar and strange. Monsters come grinning out of the patterns on the curtains and the carpet, and chairs, tables, bookcases, and wardrobes burst out of their normal shapes and become mountains and buildings and ships you can almost touch, although they're far away. Through the long hours of the night, you have the church clock for company, and the rumble of the occasional passing car that throws its headlights across the walls and ceiling. These are hours without sleep, which is not to say that they're sleepless, because on the contrary, they're not about lack of anything, they're rich and full. Desires, memories, fears, passions form labyrinths in which we lose and find and then lose ourselves again. They are hours when anything is possible, good or bad. This passes as you get better. But if the illness has lasted long enough, the sick room is impregnated with it, and although you're convalescing and the fever is gone, you are still trapped in the labyrinth. I awoke every day feeling guilty, sometimes with my pajama pants damp or stained. The images and scenes in my dreams were not right. I knew I would not be scolded by my mother, or the pastor who had instructed me for my confirmation and whom I admired, or by my older sister who was the confidant of all my childhood secrets. But they would lecture me with loving concern, which was worse than being scolded. It was particularly wrong that when I was not just idly dreaming, I actively fantasized images and scenes. I don't know where I found the courage to go back to Frau Schmitz. Did my moral upbringing somehow turn against itself? If looking at someone with desire was as bad as satisfying the desire, if having an active fantasy was as bad as the act you were fantasizing, then why not the satisfaction and the act itself? As the days went on, I discovered that I couldn't stop thinking sinful thoughts, in which case I also wanted the sin itself. There was another way to look at it. Going there might be dangerous, but it was obviously impossible for the danger to act itself out. Frau Schmitz would greet me with surprise, listen to me apologize for my strange behavior, and amicably say goodbye. It was more dangerous not to go. I was running the risk of becoming trapped in my own fantasies. So I was doing the right thing by going. She would behave normally, I would behave normally, and everything would be normal again. That is how I rationalized it back then, making my desire an entry in a strange moral accounting and silencing my bad conscience. But that was not what gave me the courage to go to Frau Schmitz. It was one thing to tell myself that my mother, my admired pastor, and my older sister would not try to stop me if they really thought about it, but would in fact insist that I go. Actually going was something else again. I don't know why I did it. But today I can recognize that events back then were part of a lifelong pattern in which thinking and doing have either come together or failed to come together. I think, I reach a conclusion, I turn the conclusion into a decision, and then I discover that acting on the decision is something else entirely, and that doing so may proceed from the decision, but then again it may not. Often enough in my life I have done things I had not decided to do. Something, whatever that may be, goes into action. It goes to the woman I don't want to see anymore. It makes the remark to the boss that costs me my head. It keeps on smoking, although I have decided to quit, and then quit smoking just when I've accepted the fact that I'm a smoker, and always will be. I don't mean to say that thinking and reaching decisions have no influence on behavior, but behavior does not merely enact whatever has already been thought through and decided. It has its own sources, and is my behavior quite independently, just as my thoughts are my thoughts, and my decisions my decisions. Chapter 6. She wasn't at home. The front door of the building stood ajar, so I went up the stairs, rang the bell, and waited. Then I rang again. Inside the apartment, the doors were open, as I could see through the glass of the front door, and I could also make out the mirror, the wardrobe, and the clock in the hall. I could hear it ticking. I sat down on the stairs and waited. I wasn't relieved, the way you can sometimes be when you feel funny about a certain decision, and afraid of the consequences, and then relieved that you've managed to carry out the former without incurring the latter. Nor was I disappointed. I was determined to see her, and to wait until she came. The clock in the hall struck the quarter hour, then the half hour, then the hour. I tried to follow its soft ticking, and to count the 900 seconds between one stroke and the next, but I kept losing track. The yard buzzed with the sound of the carpenter's saws, the building echoed with voices or music from one of the apartments, and a door opened and closed. Then I heard slow, heavy, regular footsteps coming up the stairs. I hoped that whoever he was, he lived on the second floor. If he saw me, how would I explain what I was doing there? But the footsteps didn't stop at the second floor. They kept coming. I stood up. It was Frau Schmitz. In one hand she was carrying a coal scuttle, in the other a box of briquettes. She was wearing a uniform jacket and skirt, and I realized that she was a streetcar conductor. She didn't notice me until she reached the landing. She didn't look annoyed, or surprised, or mocking. None of the things I had feared. She looked tired. When she put down the coke and was hunting in her jacket pocket for the key, coins fell out onto the floor. I picked them up and gave them to her. "There are two more scuttles down in the cellar. Will you fill them and bring them up? The door's open." I ran down the stairs. The door to the cellar was open, the light was on, and at the bottom of the long cellar stairs I found a bunker made of boards with the door on the latch and a loose padlock hanging from the open bolt. It was a large space, and the coke was piled all the way up to the ceiling hatch through which it had been poured from the street into the cellar. On one side of the door was a neat stack of briquettes, on the other side were the coal scuttles. I don't know what I did wrong. At home I also fetched the coke from the cellar and never had any problems. But then the coke at home wasn't piled so high. Filling the first scuttle went fine. As I picked up the second scuttle by the handles and tried to shovel the coke up off the floor, the mountain began to move. From the top little pieces started bouncing down while the larger ones followed more sedately. Further down it all began to slide, and there was a general rolling and shifting on the floor. Black dust rose in clouds. I stood there frightened as the lumps came down and hit me, and soon I was up to my ankles in coke. I got my feet out of the coke, filled the second scuttle, looked for a broom, and when I found it, I swept the lumps that had rolled out into the main part of the cellar back into the bunker, latched the door, and carried the two scuttles upstairs. She had taken off her jacket, loosened her tie, and undone the top button, and was sitting at the kitchen table with a glass of milk. She saw me, began to choke with laughter, and then let it out in full-throated peals. She pointed at me and slapped her other hand on the table.
"Look at you, kid. Just look at you."
Then I caught sight of my black face in the mirror over the sink, and laughed too.
"You can't go home like that. I'll run you a bath and beat the dust out of your clothes."
She went to the tub and turned on the faucet. The water ran steaming into the tub.
"Take your clothes off carefully. I don't need black dust all over the kitchen."
I hesitated, took off my sweater and shirt, and hesitated again. The water was rising quickly, and the tub was almost full.
"Do you want to take a bath in your shoes and pants? I won't look, kid."
But when I had turned off the faucet and taken off my underpants, she looked me over calmly. I turned red, climbed into the tub, and submerged myself. When I came up again, she was out on the balcony with my clothes. I heard her beating the shoes against each other and shaking out my pants and sweater. She called down something about coal dust and sawdust. Someone called back up to her, and she laughed. Back in the kitchen, she put my things on the chair. Glancing quickly at me, she said,
"Take the shampoo and wash your hair. I'll bring a towel in a minute."
Then took something out of the wardrobe and left the kitchen. I washed myself. The water in the tub was dirty, and I ran in some fresh so that I could wash my head and face clean under the flow. Then I lay there, listening to the boiler roar and feeling the cool air on my face as it came through the half-open kitchen door, and the warm water on my body. I was comfortable. It was an exciting kind of comfort, and I got hard. I didn't look up when she came into the kitchen until she was standing by the tub. She was holding a big towel in her outstretched arms. "Come." I turned my back as I stood up and climbed out of the tub. From behind, she wrapped me in the towel from head to foot and rubbed me dry. Then she let the towel fall to the floor. I didn't dare move. She came so close to me that I could feel her breasts against my back and her stomach against my behind. She was naked, too. She put her arms around me, one hand on my chest and the other on my erection.
"That's why you're here."
I didn't know what to say. Not yes, but not no either. I turned around. I couldn't see much of her, we were standing too close, but I was overwhelmed by the presence of her naked body.
"You're so beautiful." "Come on, kid, what are you talking about?"
She laughed and wrapped her arms around my neck. I put my arms around her too. I was afraid. Of touching, of kissing. Afraid I wouldn't please her or satisfy her. But when we had held each other for a while, when I had smelled her smell and felt her warmth and her strength, everything fell into place. I explored her body with my hands and mouth. Our mouths met, and then she was on top of me, looking into my eyes until I came and closed my eyes tight and tried to control myself, and then screamed so loud that she had to cover my mouth with her hand to smother the sound. Chapter 7. The next night I fell in love with her. I could barely sleep. I was yearning for her. I dreamed of her. Thought I could feel her until I realized that I was clutching the pillow or the blanket. My mouth hurt from kissing. I kept getting erections, but I didn't want to masturbate. I wanted to be with her. Did I fall in love with her as the price for her having gone to bed with me? To this day, after spending the night with a woman, I feel I've been indulged, and I must make it up somehow. To her by trying at least to love her, and to the world by facing up to it. One of my few vivid recollections of early childhood has to do with a winter morning when I was 4 years old. The room I slept in at that time was unheated, and at night, and first thing in the morning, it was often very cold. I remember the warm kitchen and the hot stove, a heavy piece of iron equipment in which you could see the fire when you lifted out the plates and rings with a hook, and which always held a basin of hot water ready. My mother had pushed a chair up close to the stove for me to stand on while she washed and dressed me. I remember the wonderful feeling of warmth, and how good it felt to be washed and dressed in this warmth. I also remember that whenever I thought back to this afterwards, I always wondered why my mother had been spoiling me like this. Was I ill? Had my brothers and sisters been given something I hadn't? Was there something coming later in the day that was nasty or difficult that I had to get through? Because the woman who didn't yet have a name in my mind had so spoiled me that afternoon, I went back to school the next day. It was also true that I wanted to show off my new manliness. Not that I would ever have talked about it, but I felt strong and superior, and I wanted to show off these feelings to the other kids and the teachers. Besides, I hadn't talked to her about it, but I assumed that being a streetcar conductor, she often had to work evenings and nights. How would I see her every day if I had to stay home and wasn't allowed to do anything except my convalescent walks? When I came home from her, my parents and brothers and sisters were already eating dinner. "Why are you so late? Your mother was worried about you." My father sounded more annoyed than concerned. I said that I'd lost my way, that I'd wanted to walk through the memorial garden in the cemetery to Molkenkur, but wandered around who knows where for a long time and ended up in Nussloch. I had no money, so I had to walk home from Nussloch. "You could have hitched a ride." My younger sister sometimes did this, but my parents disapproved. My older brother snorted contemptuously. "Molkenkur and Nussloch are in completely opposite directions." My older sister gave me a hard look. "I'm going back to school tomorrow. So pay attention in geography. There's north and there's south, and the sun rises..." My mother interrupted my brother. "The doctor said another 3 weeks. If he can get all the way across the cemetery to Nussloch and back, he can also go to school. It's not his strength he's lacking, it's his brains." As small boys, my brother and I beat up on each other constantly, and later we fought with words. He was 3 years older than me and better at both. At a certain point I stopped fighting back and let his attacks dissipate into thin air. Since then he had confined himself to grousing at me. "What do you think?" My mother turned to my father. He set his knife and fork down on his plate, leaned back, and folded his hands in his lap. He said nothing, and looked thoughtful, the way he always did when my mother talked to him about the children or the household. As usual, I wondered whether he was really turning over my mother's question in his mind, or whether he was thinking about work. Maybe he did try to think about my mother's question, but once his mind started going, he could only think about work. He was a professor of philosophy, and thinking was his life. Thinking and reading and writing and teaching. Sometimes I had the feeling that all of us in his family were like pets to him. The dog you take for a walk, the cat you play with and that curls up in your lap, purring to be stroked. You can be fond of them, you can even need them to a certain extent, and nonetheless the whole thing, buying pet food, cleaning up the cat box, and trips to the vet, is really too much. Your life is elsewhere. I wish that we, his family, had been his life. Sometimes I also wished that my grousing brother and my cheeky little sister were different. But that evening, I suddenly loved them all. My little sister. It probably wasn't easy being the youngest of four, and she needed to be cheeky just to hold her own. My older brother. We shared a bedroom, which must be even harder for him than it was for me. And on top of that, since I'd been ill, he'd had to let me have the room to myself and sleep on the sofa in the living room. How could he not nag me? My father. Why should we children be his whole life? We were growing up, and soon we'd be adults, and out of the house. I felt as if we were sitting all together for the last time, around the round table under the five-armed, five-candled brass chandelier, as if we were eating our last meal off the old plates with the green vine-leaf border, as if we would never talk to each other so intimately again. I felt as if I were saying goodbye. I was still there, and already gone. I was homesick for my mother and father and my brother and sisters, and I longed to be with the woman. My father looked over at me. I'm going back to school tomorrow, that's what you said, isn't it? Yes. So he had noticed that it was him I'd asked, and not my mother, and also that I had not said I was wondering whether I should go back to school or not. He nodded. "Well, let's have you go back to school. If it gets to be too much for you, you'll just stay home again." I was pleased, and at the same time, I felt I'd just said my final goodbyes. Chapter 8. For the next few days, the woman was working the early shift. She came home at noon, and I cut my last class every day so as to be waiting for her on the landing outside her apartment. We showered and made love, and just before 1:30, I scrambled into my clothes and ran out the door. Lunch was at 1:30. On Sundays, lunch was at noon, but her early shift also started and ended later. I would have preferred to skip the shower. She was scrupulously clean. She showered every morning, and I liked the smell of perfume, fresh perspiration, and streetcar that she brought with her from work. But I also liked her wet, soapy body. I liked to let her soap me, and I liked to soap her, and she taught me not to do it bashfully, but with assurance and possessive thoroughness. When we made love, too, she took possession of me as a matter of course. Her mouth took mine, her tongue played with my tongue. She told me where to touch her and how, and when she rode me until she came, I was there only because she took pleasure in me and on me. I don't mean to say that she lacked tenderness and didn't give me pleasure, but she did it for her own playful enjoyment until I learned to take possession of her, too. That came later. I never completely mastered it, and for a long time I didn't miss it. I was young, and I came quickly, and when I slowly came back alive again afterwards, I liked to have her take possession of me. I would look at her when she was on top of me, her stomach which made a deep crease above her navel, her breasts, the right one the tiniest bit larger than the left, her face and open mouth. She would lean both hands against my chest and throw them up at the last moment as she gave a toneless, sobbing cry that frightened me the first time, and that later I eagerly awaited. Afterwards we were exhausted. She often fell asleep on top of me. I would listen to the saws in the yard and the loud cries of the workers who operated them and had to shout to make themselves heard. When the saws fell silent, the sound of the traffic echoed faintly in the kitchen. When I heard children calling and playing, I knew that school was out and that it was past 1 o'clock. The neighbor who came home at lunchtime scattered birdseed on his balcony, and the doves came and cooed. "What's your name?" I asked her on the 6th or 7th day. She had fallen asleep on me and was just waking up. Until then, I avoided saying anything to her that required me to choose either the formal or the familiar form of address. She stared.
"What?
What's your name?"
"Why do you want to know?"
She looked at me suspiciously.
"You and I know your last name, but not your first. I want to know your first name. What's the matter with—"
She laughed.
"Nothing, kid. There's nothing wrong with that. My name is Hannah."
She kept on laughing, didn't stop, and it was contagious.
"You looked at me so oddly. I was still half asleep. What's yours?"
I thought she knew. At that time it was the in thing not to carry your schoolbooks in a bag but under your arm, and when I put them on her kitchen table, my name was on the front, but she hadn't paid any attention to them.
"My name is Michael Berg."
"Michael, Michael, Michael," she tried out the name.
"My kid's called Michael. He's in college."
In high school."
"In high school. He's what, 17?
I was proud at the 2 extra years she'd given me, and nodded.
"He's 17, and when he grows up he wants to be a famous—"
She hesitated. "I don't know what I want to be."
"But you study hard."
"Sort of." I told her she was more important to me than school and my studies, and I wished I were with her more often. "I'll have to repeat a class in any case."
"What class?"
It was the first real conversation we'd had with each other. 10th grade. I've missed too much in the last months while I was ill. If I still wanted to move up next year, I'd have to work like an idiot. I'd also have to be in school right now. I told her I was cutting classes.
"Out!" She threw back the coverlet. "Get out of my bed. And if you don't want to do your work, don't come back. Your work is idiotic? Idiotic? What do you think selling and punching tickets is?"
She got out of bed, stood naked in the kitchen, being a conductor. With her left hand she opened the little holder with the blocks of tickets, using her left thumb, covered with a rubber thimble, to pull off 2 tickets, flipped her right hand to get hold of the punch that hung from her wrist, and made 2 holes.
"2 to Rohrbach."
She dropped the punch, reached out her hand for a bill, opened the purse at her waist, put the money in, snapped it shut again, and squeezed the change out of the coin holder that was attached to it.
"Who still doesn't have a ticket?"
She looked at me.
"Idiotic. You don't know what idiotic is." I sat on the edge of the bed. I was stunned.
I'm sorry. I'll do my work. I don't know if I'll make it. School only has another 6 weeks to go. I'll try, but I won't get through it if I can't see you anymore.
At first I wanted to say I love you, but then I didn't. Maybe she was right. Of course she was right. But she had no right to demand that I do more at school and make that the condition for our seeing each other again.
I can't not see you.
The clock in the hall struck 1:30.
You have to go.
She hesitated.
From tomorrow on I'm working the main shift. I'll be home at 5:30 and you can come, provided you work first.
We stood facing each other naked, but she couldn't have seemed more dismissive if she'd had on her uniform.
I didn't understand what was going on. Was she thinking of me? Or of herself?
If my schoolwork is idiotic, that makes her work even more so. That's what upset her? But I had never said that my work or hers was idiotic. Or was it that she didn't want a failure for a lover? But was I her lover? What was I to her? I dressed, dawdling, and hoped she would say something, but she said nothing. Then I had all my clothes on, and she was still standing there naked, and as I kissed her goodbye, she didn't respond. Chapter 9. Why does it make me so sad when I think back to that time? Is it yearning for past happiness? For I was happy in the weeks that followed, in which I really did work like a lunatic, and passed the class, and we made love as if nothing else in the world mattered. Is it the knowledge of what came later, and that what came out afterwards had been there all along? Why? Why does what was beautiful suddenly shatter in hindsight because it concealed dark truths? Why does the memory of years of happy marriage turn to gall when our partner is revealed to have had a lover all those years? Because such a situation makes it impossible to be happy? But we were happy. Sometimes the memory of happiness cannot stay true because it ended unhappily. Because happiness is only real if it lasts forever? Because things always end painfully if they contained pain, conscious or unconscious, all along? But what is unconscious, unrecognized pain? I think back to that time and I see my former self. I wore the well-cut suits which had come down to me from a rich uncle, now dead, along with several pairs of two-tone shoes, black and brown, black and white, suede and calf. My arms and legs were too long, not for the suits which my mother had let down for me, but for my own movements. My glasses were a cheap, over-the-counter pair, and my hair a tangled mop, no matter what I did. In school I was neither good nor bad. I think that many of the teachers didn't really notice me, nor did the students who dominated the class. I didn't like the way I looked, the way I dressed and moved, what I achieved and what I felt I was worth. But there was so much energy in me, such belief that one day I'd be handsome and clever and superior and admired, such anticipation when I met new people and new situations. Is that what makes me sad? The eagerness and belief that filled me then and exacted a pledge from life that life could never fulfill? Sometimes I see the same eagerness and belief in the faces of children and teenagers, and the sight brings back the same sadness I feel in remembering myself. Is this what sadness is all about? Is it what comes over us when beautiful memories shatter in hindsight because the remembered happiness fed not just on actual circumstances, but on a promise that was not kept? I should start calling her Hannah, just as I started calling her Hannah back then. She certainly didn't nourish herself on promises, but was rooted in the here and now. I asked her about her life, and it was as if she rummaged around in a dusty chest to get me the answers. She had grown up in a German community in Romania, then come to Berlin at the age of 16, taken a job at the Siemens factory, and ended up in the army at 21. Since the end of the war, she had done all manner of jobs to get by. She had been a streetcar conductor for several years. What she liked about the job was the uniform and the constant motion, the changing scenery and the wheels rolling under her feet. But that was all she liked about it. She had no family. She was 36. She told me all this as if it were not her life but somebody else's, someone she didn't know well and who wasn't important to her.
Things I wanted to know more about had vanished completely from her mind, and she didn't understand why I was interested in what had happened to her parents, whether she had had brothers and sisters, how she had lived in Berlin, and what she'd done in the army.
The things you ask, kid.
It was the same with the future. Of course, I wasn't hammering out plans for marriage and future. But I identified more with Julien Sorel's relationship with Madame de Renal than his one with Mathilde de la Mole. I was glad to see Felix Krull end up in the arms of the mother rather than the daughter. My sister, who was studying German literature, delivered a report at the dinner table about the controversy as to whether Mr. von Goethe and Madame von Stein had had a relationship, and I vigorously defended the idea, to the bafflement of my family. I imagined how our relationship might be in 5 or 10 years. I asked Hannah how she imagined it. She didn't even want to think ahead to Easter, when I wanted to take a bicycle trip with her during the vacation. We could get a room together as mother and son, and spend the whole night together. Strange that this idea and suggesting it were not embarrassing to me. On a trip with my mother, I would have fought to get a room of my own. Having my mother with me when I went to the doctor, or to buy a new coat, or to be picked up by her after a trip, seemed to me to be something I had outgrown. If we went somewhere together and we ran into my schoolmates, I was afraid they would think I was a mama's boy. But to be seen with Hannah, who was 10 years younger than my mother, but could have been my mother, didn't bother me. It made me proud. When I see a woman of 36 today, I find her young. But when I see a boy of 15, I see a child. I am amazed at how much confidence Hannah gave me. My success at school got my teachers' attention and assured me of their respect. The girls I met noticed and liked it that I wasn't afraid of them. I felt at ease in my own body. The memory that illuminates and fixes my first meetings with Hannah makes a single blur of the weeks between our first conversation and the end of the school year. One reason for that is we saw each other so regularly, and our meetings always followed the same course. Another is that my days had never been so full, and my life had never been so swift and so dense. When I think about the work I did in those weeks, it's as if I had sat down at my desk and stayed there until I had caught up with everything I'd missed during my hepatitis, learned all the vocabulary, read all the texts, worked through all the theorems, and memorized the periodic table. I had already done the reading about the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich while I was in my sickbed. And I remember our meetings in those weeks as one single long meeting. After our conversation, they were always in the afternoon. If she was on the late shift, then from 3 to 4:30, otherwise until 5:30. Dinner was at 7, and at first Hannah forced me to be home on time, but after a while, an hour and a half was not enough, and I began to think up excuses to miss dinner. It all happened because of reading aloud. The day after our conversation, Hannah wanted to know what I was learning in school. I told her about Homer, Cicero, and Hemingway's story about the old man and his battle with the fish and the sea. She wanted to hear what Greek and Latin sounded like, and I read to her from the Odyssey and the speeches against Catiline.
Are you also learning German?
How do you mean?
Do you only learn foreign languages, or is there still stuff you have to learn in your own?
We read texts. While I was sick, the class had read Emilia Galotti and Intrigues and Love, and there was an essay due on them. So I had to read both, which I did after finishing everything else. By then it was late, and I was tired, and next day I'd forgotten it all and had to start all over again.
So read it to me.
Read it yourself. I'll bring it for you.
You have such a nice voice, kid. I'd rather listen to you than read it myself.
Oh, come on. But next day, when I arrived and wanted to kiss her, she pulled back.
First you have to read.
She was serious. I had to read Emilia Galotti to her for half an hour before she took me into the shower and then to bed. Now I enjoyed showering, too. The desire I felt when I arrived had got lost as I read aloud to her. Reading a play out loud so that the various characters are more or less recognizable and come to life takes a certain concentration. Lust reasserted itself under the shower. So reading to her, showering with her, making love to her, and lying next to her for a while afterwards, that became the ritual in our meetings. She was an attentive listener. Her laugh, her sniffs of contempt, and her angry or enthusiastic remarks left no doubt that she was following the action intently, and that she found both Emilia and Louisa to be silly little girls. Her impatience, when she sometimes asked me to go on reading, seemed to come from the hope that all this imbecility would eventually play itself out.
Unbelievable!
Sometimes this made even me eager to keep reading. As the days grew longer, I read longer, so that I could be in bed with her in the twilight. When she had fallen asleep lying on me, and the saw in the yard was quiet, and a blackbird was singing as the colors of things in the kitchen dimmed until nothing remained of them but lighter and darker shades of gray, I was completely happy. Chapter 10. On the first day of Easter vacation, I got up at 4. Hannah was working the early shift. She rode her bicycle to the streetcar depot at 4:15, and was on the streetcar to Schwetzingen at 4:30. On the way out, she told me, the streetcar was often empty. It only filled up on the return journey. I got on at the second stop. The second car was empty. Hannah was standing in the first car, close to the driver. I debated whether I should sit in the first or the second car, and decided on the second. It promised privacy, a hug, a kiss. But Hannah didn't come. She must have seen